Dr. William Luther Pierce, 2001, Mark Rich and the Rule of Law.
Hello. When I predicted in my broadcast 2 weeks ago that George Bush soon would drag the United States into another war at the behest of the Jews, I really didn't expect him to move quite so quickly. Of course, it's still pretty much a one-sided war. We drop bombs on the Iraqis and maintain a blockade of Iraq, and they don't strike back at us. But hey, keep up this kind of one-sided war long enough, and it will become two-sided. Did you hear George Bush and his head mulatto explain that the bombing of Iraq was purely defensive? Iraqi air defense radar was becoming too offensive and needed to be slapped down. We bombed the Iraqis in order to protect our pilots, who are in the habit of flying provocatively over Iraq every day to show the Iraqis who's boss. I love these Alice in Wonderland statements by politicians and bureaucrats. They talk about how they abhor aggression and respect the rights of small nations. And then when the Jews snap their fingers, they send in the bombers to blast Serbia or Iraq for behaving like sovereign nations are entitled to behave in conducting their own internal affairs. I also told you 2 weeks ago that although the Democrats and the Republicans might have slightly different taxing policies, when it comes to taking orders from the Jews, there is no difference between them. George Bush is just as ready to bomb Baghdad and kill Iraqis as Bill Clinton was ready to bomb Belgrade and kill Serbs. And neither of these countries was our enemy. Neither had taken any hostile action against us or threatened our national interests. This latest attack on Iraq is solely to protect the interests of the Jews in Israel so that they can continue butchering Palestinians without threat of opposition. Bush and his mulatto in the State Department talk about the need to keep Saddam Hussein from developing weapons of mass destruction. What liars and hypocrites! If Mr. Bush were concerned about preventing the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, he should be giving his stern warnings to Ariel Sharon, not to Saddam Hussein. The UN weapons inspection teams should be probing the biological warfare laboratories in Israel instead of worrying about Iraq. Liars and hypocrites, those are terms which apply pretty well to every politician in the Western world these days, and the Republicans are no better than the Democrats. Watch George Bush's face carefully when he's making a public statement. You'll see that secret little liar's smirk that he hasn't quite learned yet to suppress like the really skilled liars have. I've said this before, but the problem we're dealing with here is not just a few crooks who've sneaked into our political system. We're dealing with a whole system of government that is terminally corrupt. A system that has no room in it for anyone who isn't a crook. In this connection, let's look in detail at a prime example currently in the news of just how rotten the system has become. The example to which I refer is the batch of pardons and commutations of the sentences of criminals which Bill Clinton dispensed last month, just minutes before the end of his term in office. All the attention is being focused on just one of these criminals, Mark Rich, because he happens to be the biggest and most successful of them. But to understand the real significance of the Mark Rich pardon, we need to look at it in the context of all of the pardons and commutations Mr. Clinton issued on January 20th. When one examines the whole list of criminals who found favor with Mr. Clinton, the most striking feature about the list is its Jewishness. It's not just that Jews are somewhat overrepresented on the list. They are vastly overrepresented. Jews constitute just 0.5% of the U.S. prison population, yet fully one quarter, 25%, of the convicted criminals whose sentences were commuted are Jews. That's 50 times the rate we would expect. And the Jews who received a full pardon, including Mark Rich and his criminal colleague Pincus Green, were overrepresented on the pardon list by a factor of 12 compared to their percentage of the convict population in the United States. I'll bet you that none of the mainstream media comment on this enormously disproportionate Jewishness of those receiving presidential clemency. The congressional and other investigators probing the Mark Rich pardon certainly will tiptoe around this glaringly evident fact. What does it mean? We know that some of the Jewish criminals whose prison terms were commuted received Mr. Clinton's clemency because they live in the state of New York, where Hillary recently was campaigning for a Senate seat and needed Jewish support. Four of these criminals, Benjamin Berger, Jacob Elbaum, David Goldstein, and Kalman Stern, were prominent leaders in one ultra-Orthodox Jewish community, the village of New Square, which delivered virtually every vote to Hillary on Election Day, while other ultra-Orthodox communities nearby voted overwhelmingly against Hillary. That, in itself, is as glaringly suggestive of corruption as the overwhelming Jewishness of the clemency lists. Both Clintons, of course, are extraordinarily brazen and pushy political climbers, but this willingness to trade pardons for votes in such an open way sets a new record for brazenness. The Clintons were really thumbing their noses at the American people, and also at the political system of which they are parts. This was not so much recklessness on their part as it was recognition of the fact that the system has become so corrupt that almost no one really cares any longer, and so the Clintons could get away with almost anything. Nearly everything else the Clintons have done, however, including Bill's unzipping for Monica in the Oval Office and Hillary's running off with the White House silverware and furniture, pales in comparison with the pardon of Mark Rich. Like so many of the other Jewish criminals pardoned by Bill Clinton last month, Rich didn't steal his money with a ski mask and a sawed-off shotgun. He did it with a telephone, a glib tongue, and a knack for shuffling papers and sleight of hand. Rich, an international commodities trader, built his business through tapping into a worldwide network of Jewish middlemen and knowing whom to bribe and how much. He saw a lucrative opportunity for himself in 1979 when Iranian militants seized the U.S. Embassy in Tehran and took 62 Americans there hostage. The United States retaliated by imposing an embargo on Iranian oil, and it thenceforth became illegal for any U.S. citizen to buy or sell Iranian oil. That didn't bother the typically ruthless and cosmopolitan Rich in the least, even though he held U.S. citizenship at the time. He saw an opportunity to enrich himself and to benefit his fellow Jews in Israel at the same time. What happened to the American hostages was not his concern. He arranged for the smuggling of 6 million barrels of oil from Iran to Israel, and he took a hefty commission for himself. He also made money on arms deals he arranged between Iran and North Korea. Of course, he couldn't very well declare all of this illicit income, and so he neglected to pay some $48 million in taxes on it. Nevertheless, he and his business partner, Pincus Green, were caught and indicted on 65 counts of trading with the enemy, tax evasion, wire fraud, racketeering, and other felonies. Rich could have gotten 300 years in prison, but instead he fled the country in 1983 and has been a fugitive from justice ever since. This is the fellow of whom Bill Clinton has said that he never should have been indicted on criminal charges, that his offenses were only of a civil nature. Really, that's one of Mr. Clinton's principal excuses for pardoning Mark Rich. The man isn't really a criminal. He may have broken a few minor rules, and perhaps civil penalties were appropriate, but certainly not criminal charges. Being on Interpol's 10 most wanted list didn't keep Mark Rich from continuing to enrich himself to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars a year. He has given an estimated $200 million to Israel during the time he has been on the run, and recently he gave more than $1 million to the Clintons and their Democratic Party associates, the latter through his ex-wife Denise, a hard-faced, sleazily overdecorated, bleached Jewess, just the sort to fit right in with the Clintons' social circle. She is said to have received nearly $1 billion from Rich in a divorce settlement, and she still works for him out of her 25,000-square-foot, three-floor apartment on New York's Fifth Avenue. When the House Government Reform Committee tried to question her about that a few days ago, she pled her Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. Mark Rich is guilty of far more than the felonies for which he was indicted in 1983. If I had the power to bring Mark Rich to justice, the charge I would bring against him, the crime for which I would condemn him to be suspended in an iron cage above the White House gate until his flesh had rotted from his bones, is genocide. I'll get into the details of that in a moment. But first, I want to make it quite clear that Mark Rich is by no means the only dangerous Jewish felon Mr. Clinton pardoned last month. The impression one gets from reading news reports about the people pardoned is that they are just fast buck artists, lawyer types, who perhaps are a little tricky and don't follow all of the rules, but aren't really bad or dangerous people. For example, those four nice, ultra-Orthodox Jewish boys from New Square, New York, who were clever enough to trick the government into giving them more than $40 million by filing all sorts of applications for financial aid for a yeshiva, a Jewish school, which didn't exist, and who had their sentences commuted by Mr. Clinton in return for all the other ultra-Orthodox Jews in New Square voting for Hillary when she ran for the Senate last year. Well, listen, one of the other felons whose sentences was commuted by Mr. Clinton last month was New York Jewish lawyer Harvey Weinig. When he was practicing law in New York, Mr. Weinig's most important clients were the Colombian bosses of the Cali cocaine cartel. In 1995, as part of a plea bargain, he admitted laundering $19 million in drug money for the cartel, and for that he was sentenced to 11 years in prison. Last month, Mr. Clinton turned him loose. But actually, Weinig was involved in much more than laundering drug money. His clients customarily play rough. They don't just smuggle drugs. They kidnap people, they torture people, and they murder people. Weinig was involved in a kidnapping. The ransom money actually was delivered to his New York law office. The prosecutors actually had wiretap recordings of Weinig discussing the kidnapping with some of his associates, and they were prepared to prosecute him for kidnapping and extortion and a number of other very serious felonies, which he wiggled out of with a plea bargain. And now Mr. Clinton has turned him loose. What was the quid pro quo there? I don't know. Perhaps a lifetime supply of cocaine, Bill Clinton's drug of choice. And I won't even get into the details of his release from prison of the Jewess Susan Rosenberg, who as a member of a violent communist gang was involved in an armored car robbery and the murder of two policemen and a guard. She was serving 58 years for that until big-hearted Bill let her go last month. Perhaps there's a Monica Lewinsky-type relationship there, although I don't really know. The point I wanted to make is that the common element in the Clinton pardons and commutations is not that the crimes were all white-collar offenses that didn't really hurt anyone. The common element seems simply to be Jewishness. Well, there's more to it than that. The Jews he pardoned were not convicted of crimes of passion. They all are cold-blooded predators who were involved in sucking the life out of the Gentile society in which they live. Some by violent means, most non-violently. But the non-violent ones, the ones who only stole by trickery and deception, are no less destructive than the violent ones. Mark Rich is the best example of that. His most serious and harmful crime is one for which he has not yet been indicted. That is the plundering of the Russian nation, the Russian people. A little over a decade ago, as the Soviet Union entered the final phase of its self-destruction, Mark Rich saw a splendid opportunity for himself. Corrupt bureaucrats in the Soviet government, and nearly all of them were corrupt, had seen the end coming and had begun a massive process of looting, grabbing everything of value for themselves before the ship went down. They did this through a racket known as privatization. Here's the way it worked. The bureaucrats in charge of various sectors of the Soviet economic infrastructure, factories, mines, timberlands, and so on, auctioned off these assets to private entrepreneurs, who in theory would operate them much more efficiently as purely capitalist enterprises. The government would benefit by converting inefficient, corrupt, money-losing properties into ready cash, and the whole economy would benefit from more efficient operation and foreign investment. That was the theory. In practice, the corrupt bureaucrats inside the Soviet government made sweetheart deals with corrupt entrepreneurs outside the government. Russia's assets were sold not to the highest bidder or to the person best able to manage them, but to crooks who had made secret arrangements with the bureaucrats, and they were sold for a tiny fraction of their actual worth. Kickbacks went from the entrepreneurs to the bureaucrats, and the entrepreneurs, in many cases, quickly resold the assets to third parties for enormous profits. Thus, the privatization of the Soviet economy. Thus, the birth of a new class of billionaires, the so-called oligarchs, who often had connections with organized crime. In a greatly disproportionate number of cases, the crooked bureaucrats and the crooked entrepreneurs were Jews, and nearly all of the oligarchs who finally ended up with the wealth of Russia in their hands are Jews. The crooks, both inside and outside the government, who plundered Russia, were eager to squirrel away their ill-gotten hundreds of billions of dollars outside Russia so that a future Russian government would not be able to take their loot away from them. But all of these Jews grew up in the very restrictive, very parochial Soviet system. They had no experience at international wheeling and dealing, at money laundering, at hiding assets offshore in a way that they could not be traced. And that's where Mark Rich came in. He helped his fellow Jewish crooks in Russia with their looting in return for a percentage of what they stole. And he also did his own looting. From about 1990 to 1993, he was the biggest single trader in Russian aluminum and Russian oil. And he had his hands into many other Russian commodities as well, including gold, grain, nickel, and tin. Some of this is detailed in a book published last year that is available from National Vanguard Books, the sponsor of this broadcast. The book is Godfather of the Kremlin, Boris Berezovsky and the Looting of Russia by Dr. Paul Klebnikov, a Russian scholar and a senior editor at Forbes magazine. Mark Rich played a larger role than any other single person in getting the stolen wealth of Russia out of the country. More than any other single person, he is responsible for making a once rich white country into the economic basket case that it is today. More than any other single person, Mark Rich is responsible for the fact that millions of Russians are freezing and starving this winter, for the fact that the suicide rate and the alcoholism rate in Russia are at all-time highs, and for the fact that young Russian women, facing a future of bleak poverty at home, are letting themselves be lured into white slavery by Jewish slave dealers promising them jobs as secretaries or receptionists or housekeepers in Israel. This is the crime, the genocidal crime, for which Mark Rich should have his arms and legs broken and then be suspended in an iron cage over the White House gate. And Bill Clinton gave him a pardon. Government investigators are looking into Rich's pardon, primarily in an attempt to discover any payoff from Rich to Clinton. The primary reason they're looking is because the affair stinks so much that the politicians among the investigators are hoping to earn a little political capital by publicly demonstrating their disapproval of Mr. Clinton's actions. They may find something, and they may not, but I'm quite sure that they won't get to the real heart of the scandal, because that inevitably will take them into its Jewish aspects, and the very thought of that frightens them badly. I should mention that some Jewish spokesmen are much more open in dealing with the Jewish aspects of the scandal than the Gentile politicians are. Some of the more far-sighted Jews are quite unhappy about the very heavy involvement of prominent Jewish leaders in the lobbying effort that secured Rich's pardon. Among the 100 Jewish bigshots in the United States and Israel who wrote letters to Clinton urging the pardon was Abe Foxman, head of the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rit, the most powerful Jewish pressure group in the United States. All of these letters have been made public as the investigation in the Congress proceeds, and some Jews are expressing fears now that the public perception may be that there was an international Jewish conspiracy afoot to secure a pardon for Rich. That's exactly the fear expressed by Jewish writer Zev Kockets in a February 15th column in the New York Daily News. Well, don't count on the lemmings to have such acute powers of perception. What the lemmings will perceive, however, is that something is really rotten in Washington. Why did Bill and Hillary take such chances? Surely they could predict that they would be criticized for what they did, whether it was buying the votes of ultra-Orthodox Jews in New York, running off with the White House silverware, or pardoning such a notorious monster of iniquity as Mark Rich. It is clear that they did what they did because they figured they could get away with it, that they could weather any bad publicity, just as Bill did during the Monica Lewinsky scandal. As I said before, they were thumbing their noses at the system. Even the lemmings can see that. What they did not only will serve to further undermine public respect and confidence in the government and in our system of laws, but it also serves as an indicator of just how dangerously far respect and confidence already have been eroded inside the system itself. When the highest government officials, including the president himself, publicly display such contempt for the system, contempt is certain to increase greatly among the public. You know, I don't think much of the system. I really do think it needs to be replaced, and the sooner the better. But the rule of law, which the Clintons have done so much to undermine, is what stands between any civilized society and the jungle. When there is no more rule of law, life becomes unbelievably brutal. America's feminized liberals, who believe that we can all live happily together without laws, like the members of some 1960s-style dope-smoking commune, are in for a really unpleasant surprise. Thanks for being with me again today.